Chapter 7. All stations report ready, Derek's executive officer said from the sensor console. Aboard small ships like destroyers and frigates, the crew was expected to perform multiple roles. Thank you, Number One. Derek turned his attention to the pilot station, which was inconveniently to his left and slightly above and behind him. The Jarraptha were excellent engineers, but they had decidedly odd notions of crew resource management and ergonomics. Someday the UN would have time to modify the interiors of their second-hand warships beyond replacing couches with human-compatible chairs. Mr. Wu, are we synchronized with Marseille? He asked the pilot. He knew the answer. The status was on the forward display, and Wu knew he had the information, but proper procedure required confirmation. Yes, Captain, Wu replied without looking up from his console. Jump is locked in for 1:39. Exactly at the appointed time, Boston jumped in unison with the Marseille, less than 6 kilometers apart and on parallel flight paths. The two UN destroyers, not bothering to deploy stealth fields and with their energy shields set to maximum field density, emerged 8,000 kilometers from the heavy cruiser that was at that moment bombarding the surface with maser cannons. Megawatts of active sensor pulses radiated out from the UN ships, pinpointing the location of the other Theranan ships as the pair of destroyers fired their own masers and missiles raced toward the enemy cruiser as fast as the rotary launchers could spit them out. Caught off guard only for a moment, the cruiser fired back with masers, railguns, and missiles, joined by the other heavy cruiser that had dropped stealth and turned to engage. Boston shook from the assault, the shields flickering and armor plating ablating away, alarms flashing on the bridge. Not needing the main engines, the destroyer popped thrusters to jink up, down, left, and right in a random fashion to throw off the enemy's aim. After what seemed like both forever and not long enough, the speed of the lightly armed destroyers carried both of them out of effective range. A pair of enemy frigates were burning hard to intercept, a move useful only if either of the UN ships suffered fatal damage to their jump drives. Neither had. While the first salvo of their smart missiles harassed the target heavy cruiser, the two destroyers jumped away. It was only later, reviewing video in a time lag from a distance of 10 light minutes from the planet, that the crews of the UN ships saw their missiles score hits on the enemy. The heavy cruiser, which had the guns but not the armor protection of a battle cruiser, staggered as one missile after another impacted the shields and exploded, burying the massive ship in a cloud of blinding light. A Theranan destroyer and 2 frigates, close by to provide defensive fire support, dropped stealth and added their point defense cannons to the blazing chaos, high-energy photons and ultra-dense guided slugs lancing out to kill missiles before they could strike the beleaguered cruiser. The count of missiles in flight fell rapidly, even as they closed in to swarm around the big ship, coordinating their actions. 1 missile got through, and that's all that was needed. The missile struck a gap where 2 armor plates joined. The nose cone erupted forward, sending a dense arrow of exotic material burning through the armor, clearing the way for the explosive warhead to penetrate the ship's vulnerable interior. 26% of the warhead's explosive potential made it through to the exposed hull, detonating in a disappointing fizzle. The missile was a dud. Still, it ripped through 5 decks, severing power conduits, taking a reactor offline, knocking out 1/3 of the cruiser's engine thrust, and cutting connections to the entire starboard bank of shield protectors. The fight was over, all the other missiles having been intercepted or sacrificing themselves for one to get through. For the Theranan, it was a heart-stopping moment relieved by the great fortune of a human mistake. The formidable Maxulx-derived missiles of the humans, which turned a battleship to dust, had failed. The invasion forces on the ground were gifted with a respite from the orbital bombardment. Though with communications still jammed, they did not know why the deadly maser bolts and railgun darts had ceased raining down on them. To protect the stricken cruiser while it repaired battle damage, the Theranan commander ordered the other cruiser to join the 1 destroyer and 1 pair of frigates to provide cover. Wrapping around the damaged cruiser, the other 4 ships linked their fire control computers to provide a tight defense against another attack, which was assumed to be inevitable. The humans had to be angry and frustrated by the failure of their best weapons, a mindset that demanded another strike. The next time, the Theranin would be ready. The remaining pair of frigates burned hard to reposition away from the planet where they would be able to project damping fields to trap the human ships as their momentum carried them away from the planet. The next time, the surviving pair of UN destroyers would be hounded by ships that jumped ahead of their flight path, attacked, and ultimately smashed them to dust. The Theranin would achieve what their patrons had let slip through their claws. A decisive victory over the upstart species who claimed to be the third major power in the galaxy. While the cruiser that had acted as bait feverishly worked on repairs, its crew readied for another attack, which if the humans had any intelligence at all, would come soon. The longer the primitive species waited, the better prepared the Theranin would be. So the crews of their ships waited with unbearable tension, which was only partially controlled by their cybernetic implants. Since the humans knew the location of the damaged cruiser and knew other ships would be nearby to provide protection, there was no point to using stealth fields. The single destroyer and the frigates supplemented their sensor fields with a regular series of powerful active sensor pulses searching for stealthy enemy missiles and probes launched from long range. The pulses reflected off nothing, radiated energy continuing uselessly out into deep space. Except, it was not true that the photons of the sensor pulses did not reflect off anything. They did bounce off the shattered hulk that used to be the UN assault carrier Chesapeake Bay, a fire-blasted chunk of metals, composites, and exotic materials that was swinging within 40,000 kilometers of the Theranin formation on its uncontrolled elliptical orbit. The Theranin had quite rightly ignored the wreck of the second-hand assault carrier, other than to tag it as a navigation hazard. They were right to ignore it. Except, the bickering missiles Kevin, Shirley, Beatty, Hu Ying, Ahmet, and the others that made up the cluster of 26 ship killers hugged the faintly radioactive hull of the Chesapeake Bay, each weapon wrapped in its own stealth field. Thinking and talking and arguing at AI speed, the missiles debated who should act as the controller, who should have the glory of coordinating the attack, the responsibility for providing guidance, the burden of collecting real-time data about enemy defenses and analyzing the best way to defeat the multiple layers of protection around the enemy ship, and who would have the reduced chance of actually scoring a hit while acting as the controller rather than zooming in at top speed to kill, kill, kill. In the end, Kevin was selected, not because he wanted the job, nor because the others all thought his arrogant presumption of leadership required appropriate punishment. No, Kevin got stuck acting as the initial controller simply because he lost the stupid game of rock-paper-scissors-lizard-Spock that was suggested by Ahmet. Stupid Ahmet. Okay, everyone, Kevin tried to tamp down his own excitement. Get ready.
I've been nothing but ready since I came off the assembly line, you ninny,
Betty snapped. But then Betty always had been a bit irritable.
Well then, Kevin tried to think of a retort and failed. Good luck, everyone.
Shirley sniffed. Just don't guide me into the path of a point defense cannon slug and I'll be happy.
The signal will be bazinga, Kevin announced. When I say
bazinga, that's just stupid, Betty sniffed. Why is the signal?
Because I said so.
Kevin was tired of the bickering.
Oh, just because...
3-2-1, bazinga!
The Theranin are not nearly as smart as they think they are, and their cybernetic implants do not add much to their intelligence. In fact, the poor integration of biological and artificial nerve channels can actually impede their ability to process thoughts. The commander of the Theranin task force did not need ultra-fast processing to react to seeing 20 or more missiles racing toward her ships at impossibly high acceleration. Her first thought, as both the biological and artificial part of her brain momentarily locked up, was, followed a moment later by, oh shit. And after a microsecond, she had time for a more complete assessment of recent events. Her conclusions were, the humans are not nearly as stupid as we believed, and they played me. In a flash, she realized the dud missile that failed to fully explode had been a deliberate act. Instead of settling for taking out a single cruiser, the humans had gotten her to put nearly all of her ships in a tight pattern and all well below jump altitude.
It took only 3 more seconds for the tactical AI to ping her implant with the bad news. This incoming flight of missiles was substantially more difficult to intercept than those missiles that participated in the most recent attack. The AI ventured a guess that in the attack by the 2 UN destroyers, their missiles had deliberately degraded their maneuvering, coordination, and sensor jamming capabilities. This time, the missiles were not holding back. Their attack was well coordinated, with the individual weapons racing forward at accelerations that were many thousands of times the force of gravity on the Theranan homeworld. Then, the booster motors cut out, and the missiles disappeared behind stealth fields, only to pop up and fire their boosters again. When the incoming weapons neared the effective range of the Theranan point defense cannons, some of the missiles sent out powerful pulses to jam defensive sensors, sacrificing themselves so others could slip through to strike the blinded starships. When the defenses automatically switched to home-on jam mode and poured fire at the source of the active pulses, the count of incoming threats began dropping rapidly. Not rapidly enough. Surviving missiles switched on jamming, knowing they would be targeted, and knowing that would allow others to kill, kill, kill. The defense system AIs were not stupid. They knew that while they concentrated fire on the missiles they could see, others were racing in. But where? Where were they? The defense AIs attempted with some success to break through the jamming. Slowly, in terms of AI thinking speed, they built up a picture of enemy tactics and began to form and test a model to predict the next moves of the unseen flight of missiles which were surely twisting violently through space toward their targets. The AIs of the Theranan ships were smart. Unfortunately, the relatively tiny AIs of the missiles were at least as smart. And due to superior technology enemy jamming, the Theranan AIs were unable to network and share information between ships. Despite the disadvantages, the AIs were having some success, and the AI of a frigate took a risk. Swiveling its cannons away from a jamming source, it directed defensive fire at coordinates it predicted had a 74% probability of containing a missile. Its guess was confirmed by a tremendous explosion, and it excitedly broadcast its findings to the task force, requesting confirmation that the revised predictive model worked for them also. Too late. For most ships of the task force, their confirmation of enemy missile locations came in the form of direct, simultaneous, and coordinated impacts to their energy shields. The Maxulk's warheads were dual-stage devices. In the nose cone, just behind the sensor receivers and antennas for broadcasting jamming pulses, was an energy shield projector. The shield was not for the protection of the missile. Its purpose was not to protect anything. The instant that the nose cone contacted the energy shield of a target ship, the missile's AI analyzed the frequency, polarity, and amplitude cycling characteristics of the shield in that area at the exact time. A picosecond later, the missile's own shield projector switched on in a powerful pulse that lasted only 8 nanoseconds before the projector burned out. That was enough to bore a hole through the starship shield, allowing the second stage of the warhead to do its deadly work. The second stage was actually 3 components that worked together. A small projectile erupted forward to prematurely detonate any reactive armor on the target's hull, which the Theranan only installed aboard their capital ships. Right behind the lead projectile was an ultra-dense rod of exotic material that instantly flashed from a solid into plasma when it contacted the ship's armor plating, quickly burning through to the hull underneath and clearing the way for the part of the warhead that earned its carrier missile the Ship Killer nickname, an explosive charge. Not just any ordinary explosive charge. Nothing crude like mere chemicals or a clumsy nuclear fusion device. The Maxulks were so over that sort of low-tech destructiveness. Their ship-killer missiles used a technology the Maxulks had developed, not stolen or copied from the haughty Rindaloo. Atomic compression, a technology poorly copied by several client species, was a technique of creating matter quark by quark into atoms, directly from energy. Electrons of the resultant atoms were not allowed their normal separation from the nuclei. Instead, they were held in tight suspension, with atoms compressed tightly together. When the hardened warhead punched through the thin hull to reach the vulnerable interior of the ship and release the containment field, nothing good happened. The last thought that went through the Theranan commander's mind, Well, that thought really couldn't have been very important. It was lost to history, along with two heavy cruisers, a destroyer, and a pair of frigates. The distances involved in space combat and the resulting time lags never ceased to be both awe-inspiring and frustrating to Derek Bonsu. Boston had performed two jumps after dropping off 26 missiles near the hulk of the Chesapeake Bay, one jump to throw off any attempt at pursuit, and another to within 8,000 kilometers of the Marseille. The two ships waited, their jump drives on hair triggers in case of unpleasant surprises. Waiting, watching, as photons from the space battle that should have begun slowly crawled outward. The UN destroyer squadron assigned to Globacus did not have the advantage of a magic beer can who was able to see and communicate faster than light, so the crews of the two ships had to wait until they could see the battle. No amount of wishful thinking or silent urging would make the photons travel any faster. They leisurely dawdled along at around 300,000 kilometers per second until they reached the waiting pair of destroyers at the safe but annoying distance of 3 light minutes. 3 minutes. The first photons that were of any interest were those generated by the booster motors of the 26 missiles that suddenly unstealthed from their position tucked in close to the broken assault carrier. The boosters were like strobe lights, as the missiles alternated randomly between full burn at over 7,000 Gs of acceleration and abruptly cutting the motors to coast onward and re-engage stealth. Seeing all the missiles successfully launch was encouraging enough that Derek let slip his usual reserve to pump a fist in the air aboard Boston's bridge, setting off a cheer that rang around the bridge. "Let's calm down, everyone," he told his crew, who were on edge like he was. "No use counting our chickens before they hatch. Besides," he pointed to the two counters at the bottom of the main display. The one on the right showed the current time. The left counter reflected the time of the events they were seeing on a 3-minute lag. "One way or the other, this battle is already over out there. We're just spectators at this point." Derek was correct about the timing. The actual battle took less than the 3 minutes that the light took to reach the two destroyers, whose crews were waiting with breathless anticipation. "Bonsu," the grin on Duchamp's face was matched by his tone of voice, "you have my most sincere congratulations." "Thank you, sir." Derek accepted the praise on behalf of his crew. "I would like to bring the good news to the people on the ground. May we... as you Americans say," Duchamp flashed a thumbs up, "give them hell." "Aye, sir. Commencing deceleration now." The little destroyer Boston, which was little only compared to massive capital ships, had its reactionless main engine straining in reverse at maximum power, with the human engineers watching the instruments nervously and the ship's AI agreeing there was indeed cause for concern. Those main engines had only seen basic maintenance at the shipyard after the aged and obsolete destroyer was turned over to the humans. They were rugged units designed to produce steady thrust for millions of kilometers, but they had already burned for millions of kilometers past their expected lives when the Jarapta put the ship in storage. If the AI's recommendations had been followed, the engines would have been replaced, or at least completely stripped down and rebuilt. But the United Nations Navy did not have time to perform all the work on their wish list, so normal space engines were pushed down the priority list. It was expected that when ships wanted to move a significant distance, they jumped rather than traveling through space the long way. Ships did usually need to change speed and direction when going from one star system to another, but generally there was plenty of time to accomplish the change at a gentle rate that did not strain the engines. Boston was in a hurry, because what was left of the invasion force on the ground could not wait for the destroyer squadron to be gentle about slowing down to drop into orbital speed. They needed close space support now, or it would not matter. Derek kept his ship at full deceleration, even when one engine had to be taken offline and another limited to 40% power. The unreliable nature of the thrust was a problem for the ship's navigation system, because while the destroyer slowed down, the planet was moving around its star, and the rotation of the planet caused the invasion force's landing zone to keep swinging around the curve of where the destroyer planned to jump. If the ship lost another engine, the landing zone would be moving in entirely the opposite direction as the planet spun, and Derek would have to make the agonizing decision to delay jumping in until the unalterable physics of orbital mechanics brought the landing zone back into view. Fortunately, he did not have to make that decision. Boston's remaining engines proved to be even more robust than the Beetle designers planned, and although the radiators were on the verge of glowing cherry red, the engines brought the destroyer down to the specified speed and moving in the proper direction. "Jump on my mark." Derek watched the main display, unable to entirely give up control to the pilot. 3, 2, 1, mark. Sergeant Jates grunted as he crashed to the ground, landing hard on his head and left shoulder. He tried to stretch out his left arm to break the fall when the artillery blast threw him off his feet, but either the suit's damaged elbow joint was unable to comply fast enough, or the suit computer judged it would be safest to go rigid and allow the hard shell to take the impact. His skull was bounced around in the well-cushioned helmet, not enough to make him see stars and not enough to prevent him from rolling to his feet, although more awkwardly than his pride wanted to admit. There was another whoomp of artillery being fired, and his suit wasn't able to track the projectile, and it didn't matter anyway. The suit's chameleon wear feature was offline. Any smart weapon could track him if it wanted to waste a warhead on a single Verdcris soldier, which the bloodthirsty Kristang warriors might do now that they had the invasion force boxed in. The local clan warriors had put aside their disputes and temporarily joined forces to crush the invaders. They sensed that total victory was close, tantalizingly close, and made them lose what little battle discipline they had. Why not expend an artillery shell on a single enemy soldier? The victory, the first victory over the detested human and Verdcris Legion, would make the warriors of Globacus famous. All of Kristang society would compose epic poems about their deeds and rush to replenish whatever ammunition had been expended. Jates, seeing he was alone, except for two injured soldiers whose icons indicated they were not capable of combat, twisted around when he changed his mind. Running away would not do him any good. Eventually, he would encounter the Kristang units pressing in from the other side. The platoon had been conducting a fighting retreat after David Chaika was captured, finding success at breaking contact with the enemy, until that tactic began to prove fatal. Until an enemy starship in orbit began picking off isolated targets on the ground. At that point, the platoon had pivoted to get closer to the pursuing enemy, choosing to fight face to face rather than die in an anonymous flash of maser fire. Then, another change of tactics. Reinforcements reached the enemy, and the Legion platoon had no choice but to retreat again, trying to stay just one step ahead of the rampaging warriors behind, while another enemy ground force pressed in from two directions ahead. At least the orbital fire support had stopped. Jates hated the idea of being killed by an enemy he couldn't see. The greatest danger to him was mortar fire coming from the rear of the enemy line. If he stayed where he was dead for certain, and it would be a useless, meaningless death. Running away would not do him any good, but running toward the enemy might buy time for the rest of the platoon, what was left of it. Slowly at first, as the suit's balky leg motors struggled to coordinate with him, he gained speed, trudging up out of the stream bed and scrambling on hands and knees up the crumbling soil of the bank. At the top, he reached for his rifle, which automatically released from its holster for aim. Movement. There was movement in front of him, and since all the friendlies were behind, he did not need to wait for the suit's IFF system to identify the source. Selecting the rifle's undermounted rocket launcher, he confirmed three rockets were ready, aimed, and pressed the trigger, only to hear a buzzing alarm. The rocket launcher mechanism was jammed, either damaged or the tube was clogged with dirt and debris. Cursing, he dropped to the ground and shook the rifle, seeing pebbles and dust rattling out of the launch tube. That must have happened when he hit the ground after being thrown by another artillery blast that was too close. It didn't matter. He had been sloppy. There was no excuse for not inspecting his weapon for damage. With the camera on the wrist of his suit, he checked the tube. Now it was empty. Maybe too late. Taking a breath, he steeled himself to attack, getting his bearings in the helmet visor. which blazed across his vision with an overflash warning. Above him, a ship was striking the area with powerful maser cannons that were designed to burn through the shields of a starship. Even at reduced power, and if he was not in the intended target zone, he could get cooked as moisture in the air flashed into superheated steam. All he could do was hug the ground, close his eyes tightly, and pray that he didn't boil alive inside the suit. "This is the United Nations warship Boston," a voice boomed in Jaitz's ears, crackling a bit at first as the transmission burned through the reduced jamming that still saturated the area. "To all enemy forces, stand down. Stand down or we will open fire. We have regained control of orbit." "You lie," an unfamiliar voice screamed. Not Kristang. Even through the crackling distortion of the background jamming, Jaitz knew that voice was not one of his cousins. "Our fleet is invincible. We will obliterate whoever is talking on this channel. This is Lieutenant Colonel Bonsu of the UN Navy. Try to contact your fleet if you like, but I have news for you. They ain't here no more. All you've got left is a pair of frigates that are no match for us. That light show you saw and the debris raining down on this planet was not a fireworks display. Stand down. Legion units, ping to identify your locations." Jaitz lifted his head cautiously, the skin of his scalp still tingling from being too close to the maser strike. Taking a risk, he rolled onto his back, keeping the rifle tucked underneath him where it would be protected from another directed energy beam. Eye clicking to instruct his suit to scan the sky above, it quickly locked onto an object that was above in the northeast, moving fast. The view automatically zoomed in for him, and script identified the object as a Jarapta destroyer of the anti-up class. A moment later, the script changed. The ship was tagged as the United Nations destroyer Boston DD-07. For the first time since setting boots on the miserable planet, Sergeant Jaitz allowed a smile to crease his normally impassive face. Slowly rolling back over, he lifted his rifle to get a view through the sights without exposing his head or torso. In front of him was a smoking, steaming ruin. Trees were blackened, and ground cover was on fire. The smoke-filled air turned a ghostly gray as the moisture flashed to steam by the hellish energy that had rained down from orbit. As he panned the rifle right to left, his attention was attracted to movement and an explosion. A corpse, or part of a charred corpse, cartwheeled through the air, blown upward as a rocket in the unfortunate Kristang warrior's rifle cooked off. That was a good safety tip, Jaitz realized as he checked the status of his own munitions. They were fine, had not even gotten into the bottom end of the danger zone. But that could change if he was too close to another maser blast. A bright line across the sky to the west told him the UN destroyer was still striking targets on the ground. He should get far away before Boston's fire control crew assessed the impact of their first strike on his area and decided a follow-up was needed. His suit told him it had been pinged and responded with Jaitz's IFF code. That did not mean the destroyer in orbit heard or understood his suit's relatively weak transmission. Staying low, he walked, then broke into a trot, the best gait his damaged and power-depleted suit legs could manage. Rifle fire barked behind him, and he saw splinters fly off trees ahead to his left. Good. The enemy knew someone was in front of them, but they didn't know exactly where. Picking his feet up, using his own muscles, he stumbled along as fast as he could. The Theranin forward ground controller designated RX-7 flinched, despite the best efforts of his cybernetic implants to tamp down his biological reactions. The reaction might have been called fear, if he admitted to such weakness. He did not. Not openly, though his legs were trembling. It would be shameful to display weakness in front of the Kristang unit he was embedded with, an undisciplined group of thugs he would be happy to kill by himself. Beside him, the clan infantry leader pushed himself to his feet out of the sticky mud puddle he had dropped into when the UN ship above opened fire.
"Is that true, patron?" the clan leader demanded with a sneer. "Your entire fleet is gone?"
Struggling to his feet and struggling with his emotions, RX paused to build up the appropriate level of disdain for dealing with inferiors such as the Kristang, especially low-level local clan leaders on an isolated, thoroughly unimportant world.
It cannot be true. Humans lie. You know that.
What I know is... The clan leader grabbed RX-7's arm as the higher-level being turned away, a daring act of disrespect. We need fire support now. Call down close space fire, or you are of no use to me.
You dare to?
The Kristang's power-assisted grip was like iron, and the Theranan in light fleet-issue field armor was unable to pull away.
The battlefield is a dangerous place, the clan leader said with ominous intent.
With his free hand, he pointed to the charred remains of a third of his force wiped out by an orbital strike from the humans.
Accidents happen all the time. You could be one of the corpses over there.
Sputtering more from outraged shock than from fear, RX wrenched free of the alien's grasp and instructed one of his implants to send a calming hormone into his bloodstream. Activating the transmitter, he provided his authentication codes and requested a close space strike on the enemy position. His people had been hoping to capture more of the Mavericks, so he had not called down fire on the enemy platoon. That time was over. He needed to demonstrate that the Theranan still had control of the battle space. The reply, when it came after an unexplained delay, stated that a single frigate was available, only for a limited time. And oddly, did not request him to confirm details of the proposed strike. Also odd was that the frigate replied directly instead of routing the support request through the task force command ship. The other ships must be busy responding to the human raid, RX told himself. Willful disregard for reality was not something his cybernetic implants could correct. He sent a ping to acknowledge the message and switched back to the channel for communicating with the odious Kristang.
Support will be provided.
When?
Soon.
A light twinkled in the sky, much sooner than RX-7 expected. Also unexpected was the position of the frigate. It was safely above jump altitude, a distance that was not optimal for providing close space fire. Theranan frigates were not equipped with railguns, and a directed energy weapon was dangerous to use at such a distance. The beam would disperse and cover too broad an area. RX looked around for cover. Even in his field armor, he could be cooked by overflash. No, the frigate's gunnery crew would not be that stupid. They would surely deploy missiles equipped with anti-personnel submunitions. Nervously verifying that his IFF equipment was functional and switched on, he looked up, anticipating the bright streaks of hyperspeed missiles boring holes down through the atmosphere and waiting for the missiles to ping his IFF to pinpoint his location. No streaks appeared. Nothing interrogated his suit to verify his position and identity. Instead, the frigate was using its maser cannons on a highly unusual setting. The cannons were tuned not for destruction, but to send a message. To literally send a message. The masers created a hologram high in the sky, a hologram displaying Kristang's script. The message read, "Brave warriors who are about to die on the field of honor, we are inspired by your courageous devotion to duty. The Kristang people will forever have the support of your exalted patrons." The message faded, followed by another twinkling light as the frigate jumped away. The Theranan sputtered. His thin shoulders slumped.
Well, shit.
That is the support you offer?
The clan leader pressed a pistol to his patron's helmet. If RX-7 had a reply in mind, it went unsaid, as his brain was splattered over the battlefield by an explosive-tipped round.